Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks this week. We are in on the east coast of the United States. It is the 29th of January, Thursday. You know, if you guys have been watching the news, we had some extraordinary news this week with Apple's results. I know we talk a lot about Apple on this show, but it's sort of hard not to talk about consumer behavior shifts and what's happening in that space without talking to Apple. I'm sure if this was 15 years ago, we would have been talking about Nokia, right? But you know, Apple reported revenue of $75 billion, technically $74.6 billion. That's up 30% year on year for their last quarter. I mean, this is incredible numbers. Their profit and their revenue is the biggest quarter of revenue and profit of any public company or any company, full stop, on the planet ever. So this is pretty big. They beat out Gazprom. Gazprom from Russia was the previous biggest in terms of a big revenue quarter. What is interesting, though, is that iPhones, they sold 74.5 million iPhones in the last quarter. That's 46% year-on-year growth. So for those who were sort of skeptical about the iPhone 6 and what it was going to do, I mean, this is incredible. The iPhone itself generated $51 billion revenue for the quarter, up 57% year-on-year in terms of growth. What does it mean for iPad? Well, the iPad has stagnated a little bit. Maybe that's because of the 6 Plus as a phablet. We're going to talk a little bit about some stats around devices in a moment with the Carlyle Group. But it's really interesting to see that this is not slowing down. The other thing that was really interesting was Apple is doubling down on Apple Pay. Apple Pay is obviously a key part of their strategy moving forward. Where is it going to go? Not sure, but they were talking big numbers. Now, Apple made the claim on the earnings call that Apple Pay is now the fastest growing payment service in the world. Now, you know, this probably makes sense. The fastest growing payment service before that was probably M-Pesa. You could put Starbucks mobile app up there. You could put Bitcoin in there, but certainly now Apple Pay is making big news. So, you know, the future of mobile payments is strong. What does that mean for the rest of us? Well, you know, I want to sort of hark back a little bit here. In 2009, when I wrote Bank 2.0, I made the prediction, looking forward to NFC, that plastic cards would be surpassed by mobile payments by the year 2016. It was a pretty aggressive prediction. I think we might be. I think I might have been a little keen. I thought NFC on the iPhone would have come out a bit earlier than it did. So I suspect that it's probably going to be 2017, worst case 2018. But I think in developed economies, I think that mobile payments will probably overtake plastic card payments within the next 3 years. I really think that's probably a possibility. I know some of you guys are probably skeptical on that, but let's face it. You know, there was a few people just 2 years ago who were saying NFC was dead. The nickname for NFC was not for consumers. And here we are now with Apple Pay being the fastest growing payment service in the world based on NFC. My, how things change. Anyway, let's get to our first guest. It's a great show we've got planned for you today. We're going to talk to some millennials. We're going to talk about millennials and how their banking habits have changed. But before that, we've got some brand new research that came out this Tuesday from Carlyle and Gallagher. And we'd like to introduce Bill Cameron to the show. Bill, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Hey, Brett. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. So tell us, you know, how has mobile become a part of people's lifestyle, particularly in respect to mobile banking? What does your report tell us on that?
Yeah, sure, Brent. So when we at CG did our research, we found that mobile banking's taken off like crazy, not a theme that is strange to this show. And we found that 55% of the people that were in our consumer survey, which was made up of just over 1,000 U.S. consumers, log into mobile banking 2 to 3 times per week. And within that number, 26% actually log on four or more times per week. So those are users, I'm one of them, who are a little bit OCD and have a lot of account relationships and are looking daily, maybe multiple times a day. And mobile has really helped enable that level of, if you will, addiction.
Well, the big banks in the U.S. have all announced that now mobile's their number one channel. Of course, we had USAA Bank on and some others. We had Navy Federal Credit on last year, and USAA as well. And they both had that mobile was their primary channel already. But for Chase, B of A and Wells, that's only happened fairly recently. But mobile's certainly, quickly becoming the dominant day-to-day banking channel.
Absolutely true. It is.
So how do you think device growth is going to continue for the next couple of years? And in terms of adoption rate, is it sort of going to slow down now, or do we see that sort of healthy growth continuing over the next couple of years?
It's definitely going to be healthy over the next 2 years. When we sat down to do the research, we needed to think about what device types we were going to look at. So we chose to look at laptop, tablet, phablet, and smartphone. We knew phablet was an emerging form factor, so we included that. 2 years from now, consumers are telling us through this survey that they're going to be largely flat on laptop use for banking, if not decrement a little. We saw a number decrement, but it was within the margin of error, so we generally call it flat for laptop use. For tablets and smartphones, they'll see double-digit growth over the next 2 years, convincingly in the double-digit range. What's really interesting is that phablets, which are a moderate percentage right now, because in the U.S. market they're relatively new, are going to more than double in the next two-year window.
So, this started off with people using mobile for checking the balance. And remote check deposit capture quickly became sort of the hot thing in the U.S., whereas, and that's predominantly because we still have checks in the U.S., whereas other developed economies mostly have gone away from checks. But what's going to be the hot banking activities that people are going to be migrating to their phone based on your research?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. The core transactions remain. Log in, look at your balance, maybe pay a bill, look at your transaction history and transfer money. You go in, you look, you move something, you log out. And then there are things that are quintessentially mobile, like you pointed out, remote check deposit. That has been a real game changer for small business owners and for individuals. We're seeing some pretty neat things that are unique to mobile that are more on the cutting edge. You mentioned USAA. We're really impressed with the work they're doing on voice and facial recognition. Actually, last week alone, I was with somebody who has USAA accounts, and they held their phone up, took a snapshot of their face, and that acted as their authentication into their mobile banking site. We at CG have started to call that selfie authentication.
Yep.
Geofencing, communicating with customers about sales and benefits that are of value to them based on knowing where they are. These are things that also are going to really take off in mobile based on our research.
Take a selfie, sign up for a bank account. That's going to be pretty hot. Okay.
You got it. So
what about phablets? Does that increase the range of services, because it's a bigger screen? Can we get a little bit more sophisticated in terms of the types of capabilities?
Yeah, that's right, Brett. It looks like that is happening. When we sat down to do the research, we were seeing a real trend where tablets were getting smaller. The iPad became the iPad Mini. The third most popular tablet on the market was, at that time, the Amazon Kindle, 7 inches. And we were also seeing that smartphones were getting larger. That trend was undeniably solidified with the release of the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. So the coalescence of the phone and the tablet hits in that 5 to 7 inch diagonal screen size range. And the name sort of gives away what that is. It's part phone, part tablet. In the U.S., and I point that out because in Asia, phablets are vastly more popular than in the U.S. market. But in the U.S., where the Samsung Note series was the first credible offering, which really only came at the beginning of 2012, we're seeing a really steep growth line of phablets. And with the release of the 6 Plus, we think that by 2020, 30% of all handheld mobile devices will be phablets. Secondary research that we've done pointed out that this holiday season, 13% of new mobile devices initialized were phablets. Year prior in December, it was only 4%. So that's more than tripled in just 1 year.
Wow. Well, so it looks like mobile is here to stay and just getting going from strength to strength. Where can people find out about your report, Bill?
Sure. So if you go to CarlyleandGallagher.com, we've actually got a link to the research. It's also out on SlideShare. Additionally, I'll be in New York City at 30 Rock on February 4th speaking at NiPay.
The NiPay event, Great. Yep. So if you want to know more about mobile banking adoption, in the financial service space, retail FI space, then and phablets, then go to NiPay at 30 Rock if you're in New York next week. Carlyle and Gallagher, they just released this report on Tuesday, so it's fresh off the block. If you want to find the link to the slide share, you can get that through the Breaking Banks Twitter ID, Breaking Banks 1, or follow the hashtag Breaking Banks. Thanks very much, Bill, for joining Breaking Banks.
Thank you, Brett.
Okay, so you know, the show today, we're going to talk about millennials. And if you don't know what a millennial is, then, well, I'm about to tell you. Millennials are younger persons, that were born and came of adulthood after the year or on the year 2000. So generally, you know, someone who turned 18 in 2000 is considered a millennial. We sometimes call these groups also Generation Y. The baby boomers born after the Second World War, and then those that followed were called Gen X and then Gen Y. So Gen Ys tend to be those that are now starting professional careers through to younger. Some Gen Ys are just hitting sort of the 30 space now in their mid-30s. So these now are starting to be pretty serious customers. They are the fastest growing group in retail financial services, so banks need to have a strategy for them. Their behavior is significantly different from their parents in respect to their visits to branch, their use of traditional artifacts like checks and things like that. You might have heard us talk about the Venmo line recently. That Quartz online magazine did a great blog post on the Venmo line showing very different behavior between under 30s and over 30s. So let's invite a group to talk to us about this now. That's Sarah Timmons, Rebecca Carpenter, and Lily Tang from the World Council of Credit Unions. They've just recently done a report on how credit unions should react to the changing behavior and how they should attract Gen Y and millennials. Sarah, Rebecca, and Lily, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Hi, Brett.
Welcome along. So where are you guys calling from today?
So we're calling from Madison, Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin. Okay. But you, the World Council of Credit Unions, it's like the UN of credit unions, right? You guys cover credit unions all over the world, right?
Yeah, that's right. We are an international network of credit unions all over the world. Here in the U.S., it's probably one of the largest credit union systems with maybe over 100 million Americans banking with credit unions. And I don't know how much your audience is familiar with credit unions. We're talking about financial cooperatives that are customer-owned, and they are local organizations that have as a mission to provide financial services to working families, but also in a way that benefits the communities. So you'll get here... talk a lot about members instead of customers, and this is because we think of members as a long-term relationship as opposed to clients or customers, which is more transactional.
Okay, so in your recent report, when you were talking to credit unions about this, you know, you outlined various strategies, mobile banking and opportunities, but you also called out Kenya and Mexico. So in respect to Kenya and Mexico, how are they doing it differently in respect to millennials?
So, yeah, our very first of the 12 strategies illustrated in our publication is that credit unions, in order to attract young adults, they really need to provide their core services online and via mobile. And young adults expect to use online and mobile technology to manage their finances nowadays. And mobile also presents a really huge opportunity for credit unions to reach unbanked communities, and that's really what we focus on here at World Council. We've learned that our global population of 7.2 billion people includes 6.6 billion mobile subscribers, 3 billion internet users, but only 2.5 billion unbanked people. So that means that there are 2.5 billion people worldwide who have no access to financial institutions but do have mobile phones and access to the internet. And so we have worked with credit unions to take advantage of these tools to go out into remote areas of the world, such as rural Mexico. And we have worked with credit unions there to send what we call field agents to really hard-to-reach rural villages. They travel through mountains, stretches of countryside, and they set up meetings with small communities, and they arrive on their motorcycles and their backpacks, and they have smartphones with them and mobile printers. And they meet with these groups of people, and they actually are able to collect deposits, do small loan applications and payments, and even sign up new members while they're there just by using these smartphones, which is really
amazing. But why wouldn't you eliminate that person altogether and just allow them to sign up on the smartphone?
Well, that's something that we have been exploring in Kenya, if you want to talk.
Sure, I can talk a little bit about Kenya. So this would be like a next step, if you want to think of it this way, because in Kenya, there's two-thirds of the population are very young, under 35. And at the same time, everybody has a cell phone. So what we did in Kenya is we set up a branchless credit union called eKenya, and we partnered with M-Pesa, which is a mobile payment platform, very, very popular in Kenya.
We've talked about M-Pesa on the show before.
Right. So credit union members can use their cell phones to make deposits, transfer money, pay for their loans. And because of this strong partnership with M-Pesa, and they have, I don't know, thousands of agents all over Kenya, it's much easier for a credit union member to withdraw cash, for example, and it's much more convenient for those who live in very remote areas.
So you talked about the fact that millennials have different demands or different requirements, different expectations of a credit union or bank. In Kenya, what different behavior would a millennial exhibit from their parents? Can you talk to that?
In Africa, in general, and in Kenya in particular, I guess the difference between generation would be that right now Africa is the fastest growing mobile subscriber market. So I think they're expecting something like a billion subscribers
this year, in the next 5 years,
which means a cell phone in everybody's hands. And just like you and I, young people in Kenya are very tech-savvy consumers. They're looking for digital, convenient financial services, and they know how to do it through their phones.
Absolutely. In fact, we had Zoeli from Standard Bank on a few months ago, and he made a very interesting point. When Standard Bank was looking at expanding through the rest of Africa, they worked out that the cost of getting an unbanked person to a bank branch for 70% of the unbanked population would mean they would have to spend more than their month's salary or more than in their entire life savings to physically get to a branch. So it was clear that branching is not going to bank the unbanked in Africa, but the mobile phone has a clear approach to that. So listen, ladies, let's just have a quick break, and then when we come back, let me talk about sort of community outreach in a little bit more detail, or diversity in terms of, you know, immigrant outreach, maybe Islamic finance and things like that, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
So you listen to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We'll be right back after this short break.
time. There's never enough. You just don't have the time to search out all the latest banking innovations from around the world. But the good news is, we've already done it for you at Banking Reports. 700 hours of research goes into each edition of our Global Banking Innovation Monitor. Be smarter and get one step ahead. Get Banking Reports sent quarterly to your inbox. To subscribe, follow us on Twitter at banking_reports.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking, with features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance. Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's kony.com/BK.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We're talking millennials and in different markets. We're talking to Sarah and the team from the World Council of Credit Unions, who just released a report on engaging with millennials and strategies for basically reaching them in different markets, and which is a challenge because they behave differently from their forebears. So let's talk a little bit about diversity. You reach out to a lot of different countries, a lot of different regions through the World Council of Credit Union. So, are there different flavors of millennials or outreach that's required in those markets for millennials?
Yes. I guess I would say that the fact is that many of our communities are very diverse in nature, and Gen Y is probably the most ethnically diverse generation. Because, as you know, people move around much more than they did 10 years ago, which means that immigrants in particular are much younger than the native-born population. And if we as Credit Union want to support communities, as we say, then the answer is in tailoring products and messaging to speak to these audiences. And I'll give you two examples. One is a credit union in New York that serves Polish and Slavic immigrants. So for them, as immigrants, they have very limited experience with banks. And when they come to this country, they encounter cultural language barriers. I'm an immigrant myself, and I remember how intimidating it was to when I first came to the U.S., and I also remember how easy it was for me to open a credit union account here in Madison. So to get back to the credit union in New York, they've been reaching those immigrant communities by hiring staff that speaks Polish, by offering remittance services, but that was something attractive 20 years ago. What they changed now, because of the immigrant community getting better educated, more tech savvy, is they had to bring in the technology and the convenience of mobile banking to respond to those needs. And they did that because it puts them in a better position. Frankly, they consider the credit unions a better position to serve these communities as of our mission.
So let's talk about social media. Social media is a key factor. Physical geography and physical communities are almost becoming less important for millennials than virtual communities where their group of friends and influencers reside. So how does that affect the way credit unions around the world are engaging with millennials?
Absolutely. So the world knows that young adults are using social media, and this is worldwide. And coming from my point of view as a social media manager here at World Council, I'm engaging with people from 40 to 50 countries around the world. And actually, the second most prevalent audience that we're engaging with on our Facebook page right now is our Kenyans. So that was pretty interesting to find out just a couple weeks ago.
Kenyans on social media.
Yes. Lots of them, actually. But I think for credit unions to really get involved and get people engaged with their institution, you have to get the leadership on board. My position here at World Council is actually newly created just under 2 years ago, and that's hugely because our CEO here believes in social media as an effective engagement tool. So when you start thinking about how to better engage members, no matter where you are in the world, the thing to keep in mind about social media engagement is it doesn't mean much unless it's contributing to a business goal. So first and foremost, credit unions need to...
That's a very ROI-driven view of the world, though. It's like, well, we won't put a branch because no one's visited it yet,
Yeah. But, I mean, before you can even expect engagement in the first place, you have to listen. Where is your audience? What do they care about? So you really need to listen to them before you start anything.
So, Sarah, Rebecca, and Lily, thanks for joining us. Where can we find out more information about the World Council Credit Union Report on Millennials?
Definitely. Please go to woku.org/publications. You'll see it right there
to download and check out
all the strategies.
Right, Woku is W-O-C-C-U.
Yeah,
W-O-C-C-U. .org. Thank you.
Yes.
All right, Sarah, Rebecca, and Lily, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
So up next, let's invite three millennials on. Amanda Stanhouse, welcome back to Breaking Banks. We had you on a few weeks ago.
Thank you for having me, Brett.
Yeah, and John and Alex joining us from Utah and... Is it Minneapolis or Minnesota? Where are you from, Alex?
Montana.
Montana. I knew it started with M. So, guys, you've heard some research report today about increasing use of mobile and millennials engaging very differently. Maybe I'll start with you, Amanda, because you blog in the space on millennials and sort of some of this. What do you think is there some characteristic to millennials in terms of their expectations that we're starting to see emerge that is significantly different from their parents?
Absolutely. I think that in general, millennials have a distrust of banks and in general big companies, but especially after 2008. I know that I was a millennial applying for college around 2008, so there was a lot of questioning about financial situations then. And so, we do have a fear of credit. We do have a fear of taking out loans and are just much more aware of all the bad things that can happen. And so specifically for credit unions, I think that their focus on community and members instead of customers is going to be a real differentiator for millennials and credit unions.
Okay, and John, Alex, what do you think, looking sort of out over the next few years, how are millennials going to shape the landscape of banking and credit unions in terms of demanding different types of services? You guys got any ideas on that?
Yeah, I think that that when it comes down to it, convenience really trumps everything, and whatever new devices or new technologies come along that can be more convenient, that will be the ones that draw millennials more and more.
So they're not interested in friction. They're always going to be trying to find workarounds that make it faster and easier.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think that, I use Amazon.com as an example a lot, where if I can go to Amazon on my phone and purchase virtually any product with one or just a few clicks, it's kind of confounding to go to a bank's website and have to go through the entire process that they currently have to get a checking account.
That's really interesting, because your reference is not what other banks are doing. Your reference for performance of a bank in terms of how efficient they are is what Amazon's doing.
Yeah, and I think it's a really a tough comparison for banks, because on the one hand, they are very different industries, but at the same time, I think millennials' expectations for convenience, as John was saying, are more driven by the technology that they're using and less by the vertical or the type of company that they're working with. And so I think there is kind of a rising tide that lifts all boats when it comes to consumers' expectations.
Absolutely. Amanda, you know, how do you think millennials will be able to change this industry from inside as they start to work within financial services?
I think it will be important where they put their money. You know, of course, debit cards and checking accounts and things, but more importantly, where they take out loans and take out credit cards, and having those big moments of taking out, you know, for example, a car loan, your mortgage. In the report, it suggests credit unions have a unique advantage at, you know, life transition points. And so if someone doesn't have a credit history and doesn't really have a credit score, you know, suggesting looking at payment history, whether they pay their bills on time, utility bills, phone bills. And then I would take it a step further of having some sort of social score that would be incorporated in whether you would approve someone for a loan. And then, you know, once you have a loan with a credit union, you're pretty likely to stay there for a while.
So our friend Ron Shevlin, who's going to be up in the last segment with his moment of snark, just tweeted out, "Who said Gen Yers were going to work at banks and credit unions?" I thought that was funny. actually, there's something interesting happening here. We hear a lot of talk about the fact that millennials have not developed good credit scores because they haven't taken credit, which was historically the way you get a credit score in the U.S. You have to lend a little bit of money, pay it back, and show that you're trustworthy. So maybe John, Alex, do you guys think that there will be alternatives to credit scores that are used as models for figuring out whether to lend to millennials as a result of this sort of behavioral shift?
Yeah, this is Alex. I absolutely agree with that. It's kind of funny. My wife, when she was in college, applied for a credit card based on a pre-approved offer that she got, and the offer was specifically geared towards students who are looking to build their credit history. And so she filled out the whole application, sent it in, and she ended up getting declined. And the reason that she was declined, that the bank explained, was insufficient credit history. And so clearly the process that they had
off a pre-approved
one designed for students. And so the marketing and the program was all a perfect fit, and she was all excited and then declined because of insufficient credit history. And she was, I think, enraged
that's
is a fair
crazy.
Word to use. So,
well, that's just a broken process.
It is, absolutely. So I think the back-end processes will adapt and will change. And you know, as you've already pointed out, they're going to improve that by integrating new data sources and building, you know, upgraded credit risk models that yeah. look at more than just the traditional credit history, particularly when they're focusing on millennials.
Did you guys, I don't know whether you guys heard our show last week, but we had Jeff Stewart from Lendo on, and they've got a really interesting credit scoring model that they use, or credit model they use outside of the U.S. in places like Indonesia and Mexico and elsewhere, Philippines, where they actually ask you to, they ask you to introduce friends via Facebook, and then they ask you whether you would lend that friend money. And that they figured out that that's a pretty good indicator of whether a bank should lend your friend money. Because if you won't lend them money, then the bank probably should stay away from them too.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a lot of ways, that's how, you know, credit unions, or rather credit bureaus started, was they were just a collection of a bunch of different records that people had at, you know, the general store downtown on, you know, this person's asked for credit to buy groceries and, you know, they haven't paid me back the last 5 times. So I think it's kind of, in a way, returning back to the roots of, you know, credit risk analysis.
So in terms of your informational expectations, you know, we're now going into a world with a lot of feedback loops and a lot of data available. You know, we wear our Fitbits and elsewhere. Maybe, Amanda, I'll direct this to you. What are the expectations of relationship engagement from a millennial's perspective in respect to data and personalization? And, you know, how do banks perform on that basis?
Great. I do think that millennials do have high expectations of communications and transparency, especially, you know, if you are doing a lot of mobile banking but aren't interacting person-to-person, face-to-face with someone, to instead have clear, transparent communication channels that are highly responsive, et cetera. And then from a data perspective, I think it's one, of course, to keep your data private and to have it to be for your own use. But I think, you know, full disclosure, I do work at Movin. And so to give, you know, your data back to you so you're able to make informed spending decisions, I think is something that taps in to what millennials are looking for.
So Sam Moore said, I bet Brett King says cred in the next 5 minutes. So I just did. So John and Alex, in terms of trade-offs here, one of the things that we see with other apps and other services that are available now is that in respect to relationship, you know, we now have this sort of these feedback loops where we're expected to give information in return for some other value exchange. You know, is that something that millennials, you know, we seem to share a lot of stuff. You know, millennials seem to share photos of their breakfast and all sorts of things on Instagram, but, and that's a gross generalization, I know, but, how does that work in terms of what value are you looking back in order to give more information to an institution?
Well, one thing is expecting more personalized offers and just a better knowledge base from the financial institution. Alex is right when he's talking about how in the past there was a localized world where everybody knew everybody, and now we're kind of circling back in a sense because the data analytics are getting so good that now banks and credit unions are able to know you again just through the sheer amount of data. And so I think that they can offer that level of personalized attention like Amazon does with recommended for you features and things like that, that feel like every time I send in, they know who I am and it's legitimately useful to me. So I think that's a great service.
Yeah, I totally agree with John. And I think that, you know, the key thing is value. I mean, anytime you're giving up data, and I think millennials are probably more willing to give up data in exchange, yeah, but they need to get value back in return. And however you define that value, whether it's a personalized offer or a slightly better price or access to more advanced features or whatever it is, there needs to be some type of discrete, explicit value that I'm trading my information for.
Okay. So what's the most important way to engage you guys? Is it through an app? Is it, you know, is it mobile as a channel? What would you say is the most important channel for a relationship with a millennial?
Mobile, I would say social media. And, you know, banks going to where the millennials already are and in engaging on that channel, you know, not just posting and you know, talking down to them.
Dialogue. Yeah, John,
exactly.
Alex.
I would say mobile. I mean, it's nothing's more convenient than a phone that, or a bank that's in your pocket that you can have with you at all times. If you have a really engaging app, then you can be the primary financial institution just by having the app on the home screen of your user's phone.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm kind of greedy. I kind of want all the channels. So I want mobile and I want social media, but I don't want to give up the other ones as well.
Right, but optimized again. Okay, well, that's great. And listen, John, Alex, Amanda, John Ogden, Alex Johnson, Amanda Stenhouse, who are millennials, representing their folk. Thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thank you, Brett.
Thank you.
Well, guys, we'll be right back after this break with Liz Lumley and Ron Shevlin.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest, and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Moovin app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Moovin.com. That's M-O-V-E-N.com.
The successful businesses of today do everything they can to meet the needs of their customers. But outdated IT systems mean that banks often struggle to offer the same level of personalized service. SunTech is working with some of the world's leading banks to help them provide the products, offers, and services that their customers need and want. Visit suntechgroup.com to find out more. That's suntechgroup.com.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. Before the break, we were talking millennials. But a new feature we got for you guys for 2015 is we've got Liz Lum, who is our UK correspondent. Liz is going to be interviewing some standout figures in fintech from around the world. So this week, here's Liz Lumley talking to our first inductee on leaders of fintech around the world. Over to you, Liz.
So I'm Liz Lumley from Finextra, and I'm sitting down with Claire Flynn-Levy, who is the founder and CEO of Essentia Analytics. And you are also our very first interview for the very special Breaking Banks Finextra Women in FinTech series. So congratulations.
Thank you.
So for the sake of our audience, can you give us a quick rundown of what Essentia Analytics actually is?
So Essentia makes software that helps professional investors understand their own behavioral patterns so that they can understand where their strengths and weaknesses lie and focus on doing more of what they're good at and less of what they're not. The end game is to make more money.
So since, you know, you're an entrepreneur, I'm kind of interested to know about that light bulb moment when you decided this is the type of company I want to found. When did that happen?
Well, the seeds were planted back when I was a fund manager myself. So I was a long-only tech manager during the internet bubble. And then I was a long-short tech hedge fund manager during the burst of that bubble. So it went
fun times for all.
it was really fun on the way up, less fun on the way down. But I went from, you know, everything I touch turns to gold to nothing I do seems to be making any difference. And it was really confusing. I had a strong view on where my competitive advantage lay, and yet it wasn't showing up in the data on my performance. And really what I needed was more data than just a measure of the outcome. I needed to be able to dig deeper into where I was adding value and how I was adding value. And whether my investment process was working. And I wasn't able to do that at the time. And I remember feeling somewhat helpless. And later when I went native into running a hedge fund software company, we were constantly being asked for performance analytics. It became clear very quickly that I wasn't the only one who had struggled with this and who was looking to understand how I could maximize my return on energy expended. All fund managers want to do that. And in fact, I think all people want to do that. And then, you know, as I have been involved in the industry for years, post-financial crisis, during financial crisis, all of that, I've watched the dynamics line up to a point where there's actually an opportunity here. There are people who actively want to improve, and that's really exciting for Essentia.
So, I mean, how is it sort of different from other decision support tools? I mean, what's the type of data that you collect? How does it work?
Traditionally, decision support is focused on monitoring data from the outside world on what other people are doing and serving up ideas on that basis. What we do is look inward and say, okay, it's very useful to understand what other people are doing, but the one person whose behavior you can actually control is your own. And if your bad habits or lack of self-awareness are causing you to not maximize your own skills or to engage in an investment process that is way too long and inefficient, no amount of monitoring outside data is going to help you. So we're different in that regard. We're focused on the actual fund manager or investment decision maker and on digging deeper beyond where and when did the manager make money, but into how, what aspects of the decision process are actually adding and destroying value. And is the intent behind each investment decision or decision not to invest actually ending up being right for the right reasons, or lucky, or wrong, you know, so that you can actually create a feedback loop.
Is it kind of difficult to collect this type of data, or?
What we start with is trade data, which is relatively straightforward to collect in the equity world anyway, and market data, which is very easy to source. And so we're looking at what did you do and how did you do it in terms of timing your entry, sizing your position, the rate at which you scale into your positions and all of that. And how does that relate to what was going on in the market at the time or the type of company that you were dealing with? So that's a starting point. But then on top of it, and where it gets really interesting, is collecting data on why. Why did you go into this investment in the first place? Or why did you decide not to buy that particular stock? That you can only get by either interfacing with fund managers' existing systems, and you know where people are using things like Evernote, we can sync with that. But we also basically give them an online journal where they can keep track of every step of their process and see their data in a more structured way so that we can help them understand which parts of the process are adding value.
We've seen a bit of an explosion recently in the fintech space with a lot of new companies, and it's now the cool tech space to be. And a lot of those companies seem to be focused, come from the retail side of the bank or from payments areas. Do you think that it's fair to say that the fund management industry has been a bit behind the curve in terms of innovation?
Definitely. It's a huge opportunity, but I think the enterprise in general has been behind the curve when it comes to innovation and when compared to consumers. And yet, ultimately, these are consumers who are working in enterprises.
It's kind of hard to turn that enterprise, you know, super tanker.
It's true. And, you know, they need a strong motive. In the fund management industry, there really hasn't been that strong of a motive. People have been running money on long-term mandates that haven't been under threat. And only recently have we started to see a real tipping point in terms of the flow of assets into passive vehicles, huge amounts of attention on hedge funds not performing well enough to justify fees. You know, there's suddenly a lot more incentive to understand how to do something differently so that you can stay in the game. And I think that the survival of the fittest is finally starting to kick in. And that's where you start to see innovation.
So I've seen a lot talk about behavioral analysis, you know, especially on the trading floors and on the sell side. Is there going to be a time when this type of analysis becomes a bit more mainstream across the industry? Where do you see the tipping point happening?
I think it comes down to that point where actual individuals are being empowered by the data, and it's not just a stick to beat them with or a method of selling, you know, advertising information. So, you know, we all are having a lot of data collected about us all the time by our phones and our devices, and we're not getting the benefit of any of that data. And I think that once we are actually receiving the benefit of it, that changes the game. In fund management, the first port of call has been compliance, and in part that's just driven by the environment we're in, which is very much focused on compliance. And that means that people are frightened about having data collected about them. And yet our view is this data is useful to you. If you knew that you could make more money by making a certain type of investment decision more frequently or less frequently, wouldn't you do it? Of course you would.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about you as an entrepreneur. I know, but since you came from the industry, what has been about this process that has surprised you the most?
I think it's not a surprise, but running a tech startup is absolutely an emotional roller coaster, and I was aware of that, but living it and reading about it are two different things. Luckily, it has very high highs, so I'm having a lot of fun with it. But I suppose the thing that's more surprising is the fact that there are some amazingly talented people out there who are actually actively approaching us to come and work with us because they're interested in what we're doing. And they're tempted by the challenge, and they're really excited about the culture that we have created. And that's something that you just don't see so much in the fund management industry. Usually it's about money. You know, these guys, it's not about money. I mean, money is part of it, but they are looking for intellectual challenge. They're looking to change an industry for the better. And they're looking for a work environment that, you know, embraces them.
So moving on from surprises to challenges, what has been sort of your biggest challenge in this process?
I'd say the hardest part is as a software as a service enterprise, funding the business model is harder than I thought it would be. That's in part because that whole world of early stage and VC fundraising is so different to the investment world I come from. But in part because what we're doing is, it's not something that the average generalist is necessarily they'll understand the concept, but they won't necessarily relate to it. So, you know, what I found is that there is a burgeoning sector of specialist fintech VCs out there, and in particular, capital markets fintech. And those guys
that understand enterprise software, that understand, yeah.
Exactly. Those are the ones that to maximize my return on energy expended, that's who I focus on.
When do you feel that this is sort of interesting? I mean, you know, you've got a staff now and an office in West London. When did you feel that Essentia Analytics would be a viable business? When did you feel it was going to be a success? When did that happen?
It's every time we get an inbound lead from a major fund management company, considering that our marketing budget is next to nothing. It's a huge vote of confidence every time we get approached by one of these companies saying, how can you help us? We're interested in what you're doing. And that's a sort of ongoing thing. You know, every time we get one, that's a data point in our favor, and we measure our success on data.
I want to talk a little bit about you, and on your LinkedIn profile, you describe yourself as a flexible working evangelist. I just want to know what that was.
Well, I mean, it goes back to this point of maximizing return on energy expended. Essentia is all about helping financial decision makers be the best version of themselves that they can be. And to me, flexible working is about the same thing. It's about empowering employees to figure out what, you know, when, where, how they work best and do it. It's not the traditional sort of industrial revolution style setup that you see in the city. And that is part of, I think, why there are so few women who last beyond a certain level in the city, because they just want more flexibility. Now, that's happening more and more with men as well. So hopefully we're getting towards a tipping point in general where companies are realizing, let these people have some control over their time and they'll actually do better work and be happier and more engaged. That is something that I believe strongly in, and it's something that we embrace at Essentia.
I consider it treating employees like adults.
Exactly. And if you feel like you can't do that, maybe you shouldn't have hired them in the first place.
So now that you're a successful entrepreneur in the fintech space, if someone came to you saying, I have a really great idea for a new company, and I need some advice, you know, what advice would you give them?
Well, the best thing that we did was to start the company with a client under our belt on day one. So that is what I would recommend other people try to do. We were able to go to a client that we knew already had an active interest in behavioral analytics and was looking for better systems to be able to, well, to enable them to focus on what to do with the information coming out instead of focusing on the tech. And they provided us with a certain level of legitimacy from day one that helped us to attract a really talented team and early stage investors. And that made all the difference, I think.
Excellent, Claire. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So that was Liz Lumley interviewing Claire Flynn-Levy from Accenture. Well, if you heard the earlier part of the show and you're skeptical about millennials and this research that they're different, you'll love what's coming up next. Here's Ron Shevlin to close out the show with our latest moment of snark.
Right now, in ad agency conference rooms everywhere, someone is sharing the same brilliant idea. Hey, let's do a survey of Gen Yers. We'll ask questions that really get to the heart and core of what they're about, and we'll demonstrate to brands that we really get millennials. One recent study, apparently so important that it warranted two separate articles in Media Post, revealed the following insights into the deep and mysterious Gen Y psyche. 8 of 10 Gen Yers said that they want their lives to have as much meaning as possible. Apparently, and I'm quoting from the study, the desire for fun, meaning, and happiness distinguishes Gen Y from Gen X. 3/4 of Gen Yers said that they understand people's flaws and accept them. 72% said that life is too short to be uptight. And 7 of 10 Gen Yers agreed with the statement, I'm a realist. How precious. The generation that overwhelmingly voted for hope thinks that they're realists. But how despicable and cranky are Gen Xers that they apparently don't want fun, meaning, and happiness in their lives? And I guess that boomers like me believe that life is plenty long to be uptight. You know, there ought to be a law in market research. Thou shalt publish no research about a generation if the study doesn't include respondents of other generations for comparative purposes. But as a realist and a pragmatist, I recognize that this is likely to go unheeded, because I know marketing agencies are starved for press attention. I understand their flaws, and I accept them. But if agencies are going to conduct Gen Y studies, the least they could do is ask them how their attitudes are changing. The oldest Gen Yers are already in their mid-30s. In 5 years, they'll hit 40. 40 is a lot different than 20, no? Are their attitudes and attributes changing? Are Gen Yers becoming more like older generations, just as we older generations were more like Gen Yers when we were younger? If you're going to survey Gen Yers, ask questions that help us learn something useful about this generation. And that's this week's Moment of Snark on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.